Is every entrepreneur now destined to be an author, a publisher? Well, that's what we're going to find out when we talk to Guy Kawasaki on this week's episode of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Duct Tape Marketing Podcast. This is your host, John Jantz, and my guest today is Guy Kawasaki. He's, as some of you longtime listeners will know, is a repeat guest, author of What the Plus, Enchantment, and 9 other books. He is also the co-founder of a site service that I talk about all the time called Alltop, and recently co-author with Sean Welch, a book called Ape. Author, publisher, entrepreneur, how to publish a book. So, Guy, let's talk about book publishing, shall we?
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, you bet. So I'm going to read a line that that sort of is the thesis of the book, I think. When a self-publisher successfully fills three roles, author, publisher, and entrepreneur, the potential benefits are greater than traditional publishing. So if I correctly stated that as the thesis of the book, you want to expand on that a little?
Yeah, that's a whole long sentence to say that traditional publishing had better watch out. So I think what I call artisanal publishing, I don't like to use the term vanity publishing nor self-publishing, because I think we need to reposition self-publishing as something more craft-like. So I like the word artisanal. And I've just noticed that, you know, basically you have to make something, you have to put it out, and then you have to market it. That's the three things, whether you're a high-tech entrepreneur or a, you know, videographer, movie maker, or author. Those are the three key roles. So this book explains how to do it.
Well, and I think that certainly, you know, as we've all been talking, as marketers have all been talking about content and how we have to think like a publisher, you know, I think it's quite natural to say, well, certainly a book goes in that set. But I mean, I was having this discussion on a consultant forum or exchange that I play around with some, and actually, it's a new Google Plus community. I know you're big on that too.
Yeah.
And I asked that question. You know, does every consultant, does every coach need a book? I mean, has this become like you're not real unless you have a book?
And what'd they say?
Well, you know, the ones that didn't have a book said no, and the ones that did have a book said yes.
Well, if we could go down that path a little, I actually disagree with that concept. I disagree because I think that a book should be an end in and of itself. And when you start getting into writing a book as a means to an end, that this will get me more consulting, this will get me more speeches, this will get me more anything, I think that's where the slope starts getting really slippery. And next thing you know, you've written a book called The Schmo Way by Joe Schmo of Schmo Press. And, you know, you put in like 25 blurbs from the, you know, Southwest regional manager of Hooters saying Schmo's book is the best book I've ever read. And I guess, you know, you might find that gratifying in the sense, and you might even think it's going to help you, but that's not the kind of book I'm talking about. I mean, I think a book is a piece of art, and it's an end in itself. It's not just a means to an end.
Well, you have a section in fact on there about why write a book, and you just listed some of the reasons not to, or the bad reasons, I think you call them in the book. But yeah. What are some of the really good reasons to write a book? Because I do think that there are definitely, as you said, a lot of people that think, oh, I have to have a book because that makes me legitimate. But I think there's also maybe equally or more people out there thinking, why would I write a book? You know, what do I have to say?
Well, it's two questions there. So the first question is, you know, what's the good reasons, the right reasons to write a book? And I would make the case that the right reason to write a book is because you have something important to say that people will give a shiitake about. And that's kind of the bottom line. Now, so you have something to say. You could also look at it as a personal challenge, an intellectual challenge that you want to write a book, even if nobody else will read it. You know, I took up ice hockey at the age 48. I have no delusions that I'm ever going to be good or play in the NHL. So, you know, one could say, Guy, why'd you take up ice hockey? You can't make money doing it. Well, that's not the point. The point is I just, you know, it's a challenge. I love the sport. So if you love writing, write a book. It's okay. And another reason is because you want to further a cause. So you want to stop global warming or, you know, something like that. To tell your story of how to be an adoptive parent, you know, whatever it is. The bad reasons for writing a book are, first of all, to make money. Now, that's not to say you can't make money, but I think if your sole motivation is to make money, just statistically, you're going to be disappointed. It's not easy to make money selling a book. And as I said, the second, you know, bad reason is because it's going to do something else for you, like get you more speeches or more consulting. That may happen. It's happened for me. It's happened for you, right, John? But yeah, that's not why we wrote the book. We wrote the book because we wanted to communicate and foster and provide, you know, enlightenment and education. And one of the offshoots of that, if you do it, is that you may get contacted for consulting and speeches.
Yeah, so there's sort of a higher purpose in place first, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you did not necessarily mention, but just an observation of mine, I can't believe how much I learn in the process of writing a book.
Yes.
Which
absolutely
is great too.
Yeah. I have an epigraph early in the book that's attributed to Benjamin Disraeli saying that, you know, if you really want to learn a topic, write a book about it.
Yeah.
And this was the hardest book for me to write because I had so much to learn about self-publishing.
Yeah, and it certainly comes through. I mean, in terms of the practical sort of how-to roadmap. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
you come off in a lot of ways saying, well, you know, here's what I tried and here's what worked and you know, here's your roadmap, which is, I think, is the best kind of book, obviously, because, you know, there are 100 ways to do everything, and I think most of us just want to know one that works.
Yeah.
So you started to allude to publishing. You didn't go as far as I thought you might, and maybe I'll cajole that out of you, but the traditional publishing better watch out. But there are some that would suggest maybe it's even broken beyond repair.
No, I'm not, you know, that kind of statement tends to draw headlines. I think there will always be a place for, first of all, printed books, and there will always be a place for large publishers to publish the book, you know, the memoirs of Bill Clinton or memoirs of Barack Obama or, you know, Mitt Romney on management and marketing. That'll be a short tome. So when you have a total drop-dead celebrity, you know, Condi Rice is not going to be crafting it in Word and uploading it to Kindle and then doing her own marketing. I mean, that's just not how that game is played. So when you're truly a celebrity, you go to a big six. God bless you. It'll work out. But, you know, I don't know. There's only you know, 1,000 people that describes. The rest of us, I would probably make the case that self-publishing, at least you guarantee you'll have a book, right? Traditional publishing, you could pound on these people for 6 months, and then one out of 10,000 will get a deal, and then that one, you have to wait for 12 to 18 months before your book appears, and your publicist will give you 1 month of attention. So, you know, it's not pretty.
Yeah, so let me ask you, I guess, are you done in the traditional publishing world if there's another book in Guy?
This is my 12th book, and if you had asked me when I wrote my first book, I would have told you there's no more books coming from me.
Right,
I guess
right.
I've been wrong 11 times. You know, just to be blatantly honest, if a traditional publisher called me up and said, Guy, we want you to write this book, and here's $1 million advance, I would be saying, oh, yeah, I love traditional publishing. I say, yeah, let's have a one-year deadline. Yeah, yeah, you know, ram that ugly cover down my throat. Okay, here we go. Just show me the money. So at some point, you know, honestly, I think it's true for any author. At some point, money talks, right?
Yeah.
Let's just be honest.
You know, an interesting thing, a couple things interesting. I'm next week I'm having Seth on, and you know, he certainly was, you know, carrying the flag for self-publishing there for a bit, and his latest book is Back with Portfolio, and I, you know, I have no idea what the arrangements of that deal were, but I thought it was certainly interesting to note that that he went back to the traditional publishing route, as traditional as he could possibly be.
I mean, Seth is the greatest, and you know, if he saw an opportunity, you know, God bless him. I don't think you may find this difficult to believe coming from me, but I don't think people should get religious about, you know, it has to be self-published or it has to be traditional published or it has to be anything. It doesn't have to be anything. You just have to be flexible and move and groove, you know, how the market changes and what your customers want.
Isn't that funny? I mean, it's really just distribution of information in a way, right? And packaging of information. I'm working on my fourth, actually, traditional published book right now, but I'm also in the first quarter going to put out a self-published ebook. And I'm going to use your book to shorten my learning curve on that. But I think that your greatest point in that, that it's just about giving people, you know, the information the way they want it. I think that comes from trial and error and seeing what works. I want to ask you another opinion question, because there's certainly, I get this question all of the time. Uh-huh. And I think anybody who's published a book probably starts hearing from would-be authors, agent or not.
Did you say agent or agent?
Yeah. So if I'm going traditional publishing route, do I still need an agent, or has that sort of layer been removed from the process?
I would say probably agent, because traditional publishers are inundated not with book proposals on paper anymore. They're inundated with email. And so they need proxies, and one proxy that, and arguably the most powerful proxy, is I write to my editor and I say, you know, this guy John Jantz has just a great book. Trust me when I tell you, you should look at his proposal. That is the most powerful introduction.
Sure.
So that's an author telling an editor you ought to look at another author. Okay. Second to that is an agent that you've bought books from over and over through the years. Arguably, maybe it's more powerful than the author one, but, you know, it's as powerful. And the agent says, you know, this guy named John Jantz has a really great book. You ought to look at it. You know, I sent you Tom Peters. I sent you Malcolm Gladwell. I sent you Jeffrey Moore. I sent you Clayton Christensen. Now I'm telling you, John Jantz is the next, you know, in this genre. Believe me. The editor will look at that book, right?
Yeah.
So the editor looks at the proxy of at least this author convinced an agent. And so that already separates you from 99% of the proposals coming in.
You talked about, you know, you wanted to give this artisanal publishing, you know, this name and change kind of the, I totally agree, the vanity thing, you know, harkens back to, you know, a really negative aspect of publishing. but self-publishing, you know, is certainly, I guess we could do a whole show on this, but just sort of briefly, how has that evolved over the last, say, 8-10 years?
Oh, well, it's gone from impossible to possible.
Yeah.
I mean, that's for sure. I don't think it's gone from impossible to possible to easy yet. There is an easy path, honestly, though. The easiest path is to use Microsoft Word to write a novel that has no pictures, no captions, no tables, no bullets, upload it to Kindle. 2 days later, you'll be in business. You know, price it at $2.99. You'll make $2 on $2.99. Hallelujah. Declare victory. Oh, you need to get a cover design in there, you know, along the way. Spend $1,000 on that, and boom, you're in business. That's the simplest path. But for nonfiction authors like you and I, to self-publish a book with captions, pictures, tables, bullets, sub-bullets, you know, that kind of stuff, it's not that easy. that's what prompted me to write Ape, is because I discovered how difficult it is. to publish the book. And then I knew already how difficult it is to market the book. So
yeah. Well, and you just so you don't have to go chapter by chapter. I mean, you spend a great deal. I'll just tell people, you know, when you get the book, you will discover Guy spends a great deal of time going exactly how to do the format, the bullet, what tools to use. So, you know, that you know, obviously invaluable. I want to tell you the chapter, though, because I think a lot of, you know, how to publish a book, quite frankly, this book is also a great tool, especially the first section, is a great tool for anybody that just wants to write a book. I don't, you know, there's a lot of books on writing out there, and they tend to be sort of the more esoteric academic approach to writing what you love. And you have a really great process in chapter six that is just called How to Write. In my, you know, it really, I've written three books already, and there were some real insights in that, you know, in that process. And I think that chapter alone is worth the price of the book for anybody that wants to write.
Thank you.
My favorite part is the part about vomiting.
Maybe I should explain. Huh?
Yeah, probably.
Okay, so my theory, and it is my theory, it works for me. I'm not saying it's going to work for everybody. So the process I go through is I spent a long time outlining a book, probably 2 months. And after 2 months, when I think I have the outline done, I invite, you know, roughly 4 million people to look at the outline of the book. I put it up in Google Docs. People tell me, you know, stuff, this is missing, this is, you know, should be here, whatever. And then, so then I go through another process of revving the outline. So that already is a lesson. One lesson there is don't be paranoid. I mean, I literally put the whole outline of the book up and let anybody read it. And I got great changes because of that. So that's step one, outline. Step two is once I have the outline, I just dive into it, and I just write as fast and furiously as possible. This is called the vomit stage. I just want to get it out there. I don't have this sort of idealistic view of writing that you're sitting on a windswept on the patio of a windswept beach, and you have your, you know, your wool sweater on, and you have your cappuccino, and you know, you have your dog sleeping at your feet, and you have this parchment paper, and you're using a Mont Blanc gold nib fountain pen, and the thoughts flow from your brain down through your shoulder into your arm out to your fingertips of beautiful prose. I mean, if you think that's how writing is, oh my God, have I got some truth for you. And so this is it. You're just vomiting it out. And then the last stage of writing is, to use a, you know, kind of bad metaphor, is basically you are refining the vomit. You are removing the big chunks of food.
Oh, Lord.
until you get something that is beautiful.
You've taken every shred of glamour out of this process.
John, you've done it three times.
Yes,
is that the truth?
It is absolutely the truth. In fact, all the thinking about the cappuccino and the wool sweater is just excuses not to write.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, truly, you know, when you are a writer, you can write in coach on United Airlines. You could write in Southwest Airlines. You could be in the seat on Southwest Airlines. You know where the seat, there's one in front of you,
yeah,
that they're spacing you. You know, that's the worst seat in the entire airline business. You could write sitting in that seat when you want to write.
Yep. There's a great book, maybe you're familiar with, by Anne Lamott, called Bird by Bird.
Yeah.
About writing, and she calls it shitty first drafts, and I think it's kind of the same
the
idea.
The vomit concept.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You touched on the cover idea, and I think that, you know, that's one of those things that, you're right, traditional publishers, at least in my experience, they've kind of said, here are a couple options, what do you think? And you've done a couple really creative things for, you know, everything from contests to crowdsourcing.
Yeah. First of all, just to provide more insight, what a traditional publisher says is, here's a couple, what do you think? And they don't stop there. They also say, and by the way, if you want your book to come out on schedule, we cannot make any more, so pick one of these two.
Right.
So what I've used a crowdsource site, CrowdSpring, where you put up the specs and people design it and you pay the winner. this book, I actually knew a designer, so I knew a designer in advance, and I asked her and only her to design the book. I love the crowdsource idea. That's how I got the design for a previous book called Enchantment with the butterfly on it. That was an idea from the crowd. And I will tell you, I will give you a warning, though, that particularly if you're visible, when you do something like crowdsource a book cover, you are going to take a ton of crap from designers.
Oh, right.
And what they're going to say is, you know, we are designers. We are not indentured servants. So you're running a contest where you're going to get, you know, 100 ideas, and you're only going to pay one, and so you're screwing the other 99 people. And, you know, according to Clause 23C of the Association of Graphic Artists of, you know, International of America, or I don't know, whatever that graphic artist thing is, it says no spec work. Spec work means you design it. If we like it, we'll pay for you. And so they're going to accuse you of enslaving people, of ripping people off, you know, blah, blah, blah. I took a lot of crap for that. And my attitude is, you know, I don't know what profession in the world is there one where it's, you say, you create a proposal, but you have to pay me for the proposal. I don't, you know, I don't know.
And keep paying me till I get it right.
Yeah, I don't understand that. And so my response is, if you don't want to enter the contest, don't enter. I'm not forcing you to enter this CrowdSpring thing. And you know, a lot of people looked at it like, huh, I have a 1 in 100 chance of designing Guy's cover, and that would be great for my portfolio, and it would launch me. Now, you know, if you're Paul Rand, or you know, if you're some world famous designer, you're not going to enter.
Right.
You don't need the platform. Hallelujah! I don't expect you to enter. But if you're a student and you say, "I got a 1 in 100 shot of making $1,000 and being able to say I designed Guy Kawasaki's book cover," why not? I mean, do people enter writing contests? Yeah, why not?
Yep, absolutely. So, what are and this may be hard for you to answer because there are so many answers to this, but what are some of the pitfalls or some of the things that you kind of bumped up against and said, wait a minute, serious? I have to do it this way?
Well, one pitfall that I learned about is I didn't realize when I first self-published What the Plus, I looked at Kindle's deals, and Kindle's deals were 35% royalty or 70% royalty. So I looked at that. I didn't read the fine print. I said, oh, well, there must be a mistake here. Why would anybody pick 35% when you can get 70%? So I checked the 70% box, right? And I learned subsequently that at the 70% rate, what Amazon does is it charges you a transfer fee or a data fee.
For downloading, right?
Yeah, for downloading. And so if you have a book like What the Plus, which has 120 pictures in it, it's getting up there. So if it's like they charge you per megabyte, and so there is a point where if you have too many pictures and your file size is larger and they're charging you per megabyte, there's a place where it's better to take 35% with no delivery fee than 70% with a delivery fee. So that's something I learned the hard way, but you know, that's one pinfall that people should be aware of.
There is a little bit of a growing trend that suggests, you know, Amazon's and the BNNs and, you know, the people that are using all these e-readers represent a market that maybe you can't reach on your website or through email or various avenues. So there's a growing trend. I've seen some people putting out very low-cost ebooks, putting out, hey, the first 1,000 are free. And I'm guessing the model is to build audience perhaps for other products and services. Do you see that as a legitimate use of that distribution channel?
With the caveat that I think that a book should be an end in and of itself. And so, you know, it depends on you're putting out this 99-cent book so that people hire you as a consultant. you know, again, I say the warning bells should go off. I think even a 99-cent book should be a valuable thing without engaging you later.
Yeah.
But with that caveat, yeah. And, you know, if you wrote a 50-page book about how to build a wood canoe, hallelujah. I mean, why not? Right? So, you know, it's like Instructables or Make magazine on steroids, and you charge $99. If you're the world's greatest wood canoe maker and you want to make a wood canoe manual for 99 cents and evangelize the concept of making wood canoes, you know, praise God. God bless you. Go for it, man. Yeah. That's the beauty of self-publishing, or artisanal publishing. Like, could you imagine going to Penguin or Simon & Schuster or Random House saying, I want to write a book, How to Make a Wooden Canoe? Get up. Don't hold your breath, man.
Well, actually, one of my favorite things is some of your rejection letters. I'm sure that there's some editors out there that didn't want to see their names on those.
Well, you know, when I started, I got rejected all over the place, too. So I saved those. I framed them. I knew someday I'd get them back.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, the sort of funny thing about my path and experience was completely different. And this just shows you how the world has changed. I was writing a blog. My blog was starting to get a lot of attention when all of a sudden everybody said, oh, you got to go find these bloggers. And I had three or four offers to write a book called Duct Tape Marketing before I really had even convinced myself I was going to write a book called Duct Tape Marketing. So,
obviously you said yes.
I actually, what I did is I called up, Michael Gerber. I called up Michael Gerber and I said, should I get an agent? And he said, yes, you should get an agent. And here's his name. And it's funny how those agents will return your phone call when you say, I have a couple offers from publishers.
Yeah.
So,
and arguably, just the math is that if an agent gets you, you know, 20% more than you would have gotten yourself, you break even, right?
Right.
So anything above that is cream. And one of the beauties, like I have a speaking agent and I have a book agent. A lot of the utility of both entities is that they can say with a straight face that, you know, guy requires X dollars to speak here and X dollars to speak there. And by the way, you know, if you want a first class speech, he's flying first class. And I don't, you know, when people get me on the phone, they say, you know, we have a limited budget and it's for a really good audience and it's strategic and nobody, not even the CEO of our company is going to fly first class and stay in a nice room. So can you make this one exception? You know, usually I buckle under, but
right.
if it's Trixie, the agent, she's saying, nope.
Yeah.
This is the price, first class airfare. Lots of people want him. Make a choice.
Yep.
There's certain goodness in that.
Well, no, you're right. I'm afraid I buckle too easily as well.
I know. That's the worst thing. I never want someone who wants me to speak to get me on the phone because I know it's going to cost me money. And I don't mean time.
I mean
thousands of dollars.
So let's first off, I know you've created a site just for the book. I think it's apebook.com.
Ape the book, yeah.
Ape the book, sorry. Obviously, GuyKawasaki.com, you've got information about as well. You're distributing the book everywhere. I want to kind of end today with the subject of reviews.
Yes.
Are they make it or break it? And these obviously a lot of people have heard of Guy Kawasaki, for example, that, you know, they don't maybe need the reviews. Obviously, I guess if you see negative reviews, that would be a red flag. But But if I'm, you know, I'm not a household name, I probably need to invest in getting those reviews as kind of social proof, don't I?
No question. So this is my logic. In the old days, you used as a proxy who published the book. You know, Random House published the book. Wow, must be good. Simon & Schuster, Penguin, you know, go down the short list. So you never heard of John Jantz, but Random House published him? Must be good, right?
Yeah, right.
Today, when you go to Amazon, whether you're buying a Kindle ebook or, you know, the paper book, you look at John Jantz, Duct Tape Marketing, 5 stars, published by, I don't even know who the hell published your book. I don't even care. So I look at that, I say 5 stars. I read the first review, you know, this book truly explained marketing to me in a way that I could never, ever have gotten before. click on the, you know, one click buy, right?
Right.
So does anybody care who the publisher is anymore? Not really. So what do they care about? Number of stars and what these reviewers say. That's the greatest thing. I mean, and if you get a lot of stars,
yeah,
it's right. Very good. I think it's crucial. I mean, arguably, it's the most important thing. So you have to make people aware that the book exists, and then when they check it out, they have to see it. Believe it or not, Ape, after less than a week, has about 140 reviews, of which 131 are 5-star.
Yeah.
And it can't get better than that.
Right. But I guess, and you spend some time talking about this, I mean, it's so important that, you know, you hope that some fairy dust gets sprinkled on your book and everybody just wants to rush and write a review about it. But you have to actually work that a little bit, right? I mean, I'm not saying that you did in your case, but I think a lot of people,
I did.
So
I'll explain what I did.
Okay, great.
First of all, you know, people should understand for marketing, whether it's book, movie, company, product, you know, whatever, female vibrators, whatever you're selling, hope is not a strategy. So in this case, the goal is to get a lot of reviews right away that are good, right? And so the start of that, obviously, is you have to have a good book.
Yep.
Okay? So let's just assume you have a good book. So what I did is, in the final stages of writing Ape, I asked for people to edit it, to copy edit it, and about 250 people volunteered. I sent the full word manuscript to 250 total strangers all over the world. About 60 of them returned the manuscript with comments, hundreds of comments that were incorporated into the book, making it much better. So these 60 people had read the full manuscript 3 weeks before the book came out. And then about 4 or 5 days before the book came out, when it was pretty final, I also posted a message to all my social media outlets saying, anybody who wants to review the book, you know, go sign up here. So at that, I sent it out to another 1,000 or so people. So before the book went live on Amazon, about 1,000 or 1,100 people had read the book. So now the book went live Monday night, Sunday night at midnight. So Sunday night at 7 p.m., I sent an email to 1,100 people saying the book is going to go live tonight at midnight. It would be very helpful if you reviewed it as soon as you could, because it's very good to have good reviews right away, right?
Yep.
And so midnight comes, I wake up the next morning, there's 45 5-star reviews. That wasn't by accident. Now, some people have looked at the 130 5-star reviews and said, "Guy, this is total bullshit. You know, you're using shills. It's false identity. You've paid people." Absolutely not. There's not maybe there are fake accounts in there, but it's not me. There's not one shill. There's not $1 was paid to anybody to do a review. It's because, A, I think the book is good, but B, that I worked the crowd. I mean, I asked for their help. I got their help. I asked them for more help. They got an early look at my book. So it was mutually beneficial. And, you know, you got to learn to trust people, and you got to learn to give people something. They got an advanced look at Ape.
And obviously,
extremely well.
Obviously, it was just as possible that they would have written 2-star reviews.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Because there was no quid pro quo. I mean, it's a total crapshoot.
Yep. So I think that's a great lesson and a great, I mean, that. You know, that strategy, obviously you have to have a little bit of a community, but if you don't have a community, there are public ways you can put stuff out there. I have found this to be true too. Obviously you have built a following, so you can make those numbers bigger. But I think that in this day and age that we live in, I think there are a lot of people that want to contribute, that want to collaborate, that want to be a part of the process. And I think there are a lot of people willing to do that. And I think the key, though, is that you also then incorporated a lot of those good changes, too. I mean, it's a win for everybody.
In my books, I have been crowdsourcing feedback from the outline to the final copy for, you know, 4 books now. Man, it's just works so well. Now, some people may say, well, Guy, you know, it helps that you have 4 million followers on these various social media sites.
Right.
That is definitely true. But 1/3 of the book explains how to get a following, basically. So I don't want people to think that, yeah, you know, God, this only works if you have 4 million followers. I wasn't born with 4 million followers. I got 4 million followers, right? And so I explain how to get, you won't get 4 million, but I explain how to get followers. Because for me to get 50 people to read the book and copy edit it and edit it is one thing. But, you know, if you got 5 or 10, that would be plenty for most people.
Well, and I think one of the really great points, too, about this idea of, you know, crowdsourcing the outline and whatnot, it's like people have been with you through the whole process. And that's
exactly,
that's how you start building that community. Before you ever have anything to sell, you were actually conversing with a group. And I think that's the lesson that that people can, you know, that idea of build your community, start building your community now. And you know, then you can go to work on this book.
What a concept, huh?
Yeah, no kidding. Guy, it's always great to catch up with you. And again, I love the book. Really, really practical. There's so few practical how-to guides that get written these days. And anybody who's thinking about writing a book, certainly anybody who's thinking about then publishing that book, really, you've saved them maybe years of their life in trying to figure that out.
Well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Well, hopefully we'll catch up with you out there in sunny California sometime. I don't think I'm back out there till spring sometime for a conference.
Or CES or South by Southwest.
There you go. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Guy.
Thank
Always
you.
Always great to talk to you.
Bye-bye.